Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, the first month is only 99 cents. And there are multiple plans to choose from, including a three-month plan and an annual plan. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. 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 Everybody, friends, family, everyone, thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. That's right, you got us. It's me and mi amigo across the table as always, the Philio, Mr. Kyle Filson. Philly.
Yes, sir.
Fill me in on how the brud did. I come watch the practice game, even though it was kind of cold, man. It turned off chilly that evening. But how did they fare Saturday? I know you said it was going to be tough. How did it work out for
yeah,
them?
Yeah, they got beat like 9-3.
Did they look good?
They looked good. I mean, the team they played was mostly 12-year-old team.
Ooh.
And they were also last year's like regional champions. And they've been playing together as a group for like three seasons. So
oh, that makes a huge difference.
We're a brand new team. Yeah. You know, Jacob's only 9. And most of the other kids are 11 and 12.
Now, but, you told me he did some pitching.
Yeah, he did good. He struck out four guys.
Nice. I mean,
which made him feel good, you know. But nice. We just had a little bit of trouble with the hitting because those kids are just better pitchers. That's what I told Jacob. You know, they hit two home runs out of the park, you know, and I was like, look, man, we throw a strike and they hit it out. That's just part of the game, so don't get too down on yourself.
Yeah, it happens.
But it was a beautiful day on Friday, but when we played the game Saturday morning at about 8 a.m., I mean, it was cold, so it started to rain. It's just been nasty. And I know it's the time of year, but I hate it when it goes up and down, when it's like a beautiful spring day and then all of a sudden it's winter again. I'm like, right? just stay consistent. I don't even mind if it's bitterly cold. Just stay bitterly cold for 3 weeks straight and then get nice and warm for 3 weeks straight, then get hot. But just consistency is what I like.
That's you're right. It's either nasty or it is. It's like every other day. And I think there's a lot of people in this country going through that. It seems to be a lot of funky weather, the ups and downs going right about now. It's not the norm of what we used to have.
Well, you know, weather's cyclical just like everything else. So, you know, just seems to be a time of unrest right now. I don't know that all of it is necessarily caused by man, but definitely some of it probably contributes to that.
Oh, yeah.
But all in all, yeah, it was good times, good times. What did you do this weekend?
Well, after we had talked on the Elite Show, I said I was going to go, and I went Friday with my niece and did a little disc golfing.
Oh, yeah? How's that?
Oh, I had a blast, man. Holy moly, that's fun. I did not realize it was going to be that much fun. Now, like you had said before, when he talked about it at first, I got a ton of emails about it. So anybody out there that's disc golfing,
email the show. Hit me up. Tell me some of your favorite discs. You know, tell me what you like. I don't know, man. I've got a handful of some. You know, I probably got 8 or 10 now that I've picked from guys of like, here, you know, try this one, or they give me that one, or go buy this one and let me try that. But then we ran into an old friend of ours from you and I went to school with, Justin Ray, was out there. So Justin ran into him, and then he's like, hey, let's go play Saturday. So I ended up playing 18 on Friday, and then Saturday morning early, we left, went up here north of town and played 36 holes up there of disc golf. So by the time I got home Saturday, I was tired. I did a lot of the golfing. So, man, I love it. I really have. It's fun. It's one of those things I think I'm going to really enjoy, to get out and walk around, and there's a lot of places to play and all that stuff.
So. I'm shocked at how many people that listen to this show actually do it.
I was blown away by the number of emails. So yeah, man, it's fun. Look, so folks, I wish I'd have done it earlier. You know what I mean? It's one of those things. You're like, why didn't I pay attention? Because I was one of those guys that would drive by and make fun of them when I saw them. Like, look at these fools throwing a frisbee. Then I get out there and try to throw it, and you talk about frustrating, dude.
I'll be honest. I didn't know. I still know nothing about it. I always thought that the people that were doing disc golf were all stoners.
Yeah.
Because everybody I knew that liked to toke, that's what they would do.
We'd go play disc golf. Yeah.
I'm not hating.
Yeah.
You smoke a little smoke. You look at the trees. You look at a squirrel. You know, you throw a frisbee. You pick it up. I mean, what's wrong with that?
It sounds like you're hating on your job. You just wish you was out there doing that. That's what it sounds like to me.
For real.
Real talk. Hey, I've got something. We're going to jump into the news. All right. Here we go, guys. This is something that's pretty cool because we've joked about it. We've talked about it. Me and Kyle have daydreamed about it. Here we go. This comes from the BBC. SpaceX is going to fly 2 tourists around the moon in 2018.
That's so right. A year from now?
Next year. Yes. Says the mission is planned for late 2018. And the CEO of SpaceX, the man himself, Elon Musk, said that adding the tourists have already paid a significant deposit. Okay, that's what they've already put money down. It says, this presents an opportunity for humans to return to deep space for the first time in 45 years. The 2 unnamed people will fly aboard a spaceship, which is set for its first unmanned test flight later this year. Now, Elon said in the cooperation of America's NASA Space Agency that have made the plan possible, he said that 2 passengers, and this is what it, quote, will travel faster and further into the solar system than any before them. And it says Mr. Musk declined to reveal their identities, only saying that they knew each other and that it's nobody from Hollywood. He goes on to say this, that like the Apollo astronauts before them, these individuals will travel into space carrying the hopes and dreams of all mankind, driven by the universal human spirit of exploration. And we expect to conduct health and fitness tests as well as begin initial training later this year. Now, the first mission would be unmanned, and the next one with crew was expected to be in the second quarter, says, of 2018. And then the billionaire entrepreneur and inventor, that's what they call him, you know, that's what he's saying. So they're going to launch the unmanned, trial that out, and then the next one will be later on in the second quarter of 2018. We'll have folks in it. He also said that the first passengers are entering this with their eyes open, knowing that there is some risk here. He says this, they are certainly not naive, and we will do everything we can to minimize that risk, but it's not zero. Now, they say that the space tourist will make a loop around the moon, skimming the lunar surface, and then going well beyond. And this mission will not involve a lunar landing. It says if NASA decided it wanted to be the first to take part in a lunar flyby mission, then the agency, of course, would have priority. So that's what they're talking about. If NASA steps forward and says, well, we're going to do it, this whole thing. But it says Sir Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic venture proposes to send tourists on short. Now, we covered this, suborbital flights in the vehicle Spaceship Two.
Yeah, shouldn't they be trying to do that before they try to make missions to the moon? Like, what's the matter with just taking some tourists and orbiting the Earth a few times?
Well, that's what they're talking about doing, is they're not trying to get to the moon. They're not even worrying about landing on the moon at all.
Oh, I thought they were taking a trip to the moon.
No. That's what he said. If NASA decided it wanted to be first to take part in a lunar flyby, then the agency would have priority.
I got you.
So the NASA, if they did anything like that, it would be. It sounds like that's what we're getting to, though. It does sound like, as this goes around, you know what I'm saying, as this keeps going and they keep trying this, say this is a success. Because here's the deal. The seat cost for the Virgin Galactic flight, my tongue got fat like it got stung by a wasp. The seat cost for that is 250 large, baby.
That's it? That's pretty cheap.
Yeah, $250,000, and you can do a suborbital flight. Now, I've not found anywhere what he's saying it will cost to fly with Elon, you know, to go up with his group. What I'm hoping to do is maybe in the next few years, maybe this will get cheaper to where it becomes one of those things like instead of taking a cruise or something like that, you can go do it.
Well, how they
you don't want it to be cheap?
No, how are they going to keep the lid on the Earth being flat if they're just taking people up there all the time?
Oh, and we didn't land on the moon.
You
got to
swear them in. They're going to be part of the...
they're going to be part of that shill money. It's going to be paying off a lot of those folks.
Dude, I would totally do it. That sounds incredible to go on a voyage around and, you know, orbit the Earth and everything or to the moon. I would do it. Would you do it?
I would do it if I had the $250,000, like I had endless supply of money.
Yeah.
I would do it. But if I only had that much to spend...
No, I'm not saying if I had I would spend my
No, what I'm saying is I would rather
money.
Go around this planet and see a whole bunch of stuff that I've never seen before I went off into space. But if I had the means to do it, then yes, I would love to try it. But I would still be a little... You know, there's still that in the back of your mind. If something goes wrong, it's over, man.
Well, yeah,
there's no mistake.
Man, you take that chance every time you step out of your house, though. You know what I mean? It could always be over if you got killed in a car crash. I mean, it could be over if you had a massive stroke. I'm not worried about stuff like that, but I'm saying these trips.
You're not worried about all the space junk you've covered and reported that you said was scared the hell out of? You're not worried about that.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, exactly. See, I didn't forget about that.
I wasn't thinking about
that.
So
you fly through that. No. See, now you're like, wait a minute. Let me keep my 250 large. I'll just buy a beer joint.
I would still do it. You know, I would just.
Well, and they don't talk about that. And that's what I wonder. Are we below it? You know, like we talked about, are there belts of it? Because that's what I'm thinking, is rings of space junk. And maybe I can be below that ring of space junk.
Well, you know, you're talking to somebody who has no idea. But I would totally do it. I mean, this makes more sense to me to go and take a trip and come back than these guys that are going to Mars, a one-way ticket. That doesn't sound fun at all.
No, that doesn't sound fun. But this is something that I'm hoping in the next several years, maybe the next 10, 15 years, the way technology goes, is this will be affordable for almost any person to go try it.
Yeah, well, you know, Donald Trump, he recently talked about enlarging what the heck? Something just knocked off this counter over here.
There's the ghosts.
There's a gremlin down here. He's increased the military budget, and they said that last week military bigwigs gathered in Orlando for an annual air warfare symposium to discuss big plans for big weapons that do big damage. I wished I could have went to that symposium. According to the report, the biggest unfunded project that U.S. Special Operations Command hopes to push through is a C-130 that's equipped with a powerful laser weapon. Now, Lieutenant General Brad Webb, the head of the Air Force Special Operations Command, tells Defense One that he's very optimistic about this project. He said that there are a lot of vendors that are really contributing to and continue to push that technology along. They say that this project has been floating around as a potential R&D effort for years. And back in 2015, Lieutenant General Brad Heithold, who was then head of the Air Force Special Operations Command, told Breaking Defense that he believes we can put a high-energy laser beam, offensive and defensive, on an AC-130 by the close of this decade. Now, Webb also says that the airborne laser program that attempted out as a defensive laser on the nose of a 747 jetliner has turned defense officials off of the technology. It never made it past it to the stage of actually producing an operational aircraft, and it was canceled back in 2012. But according to Webb, things have changed, and as technology has improved, the project could get off to the ground very soon. First, he says a relatively low kilowatt laser will need to be tested, and the money is reportedly already in place for it. Lasers have already demonstrated by Boeing to be capable of burning a hole in the hood of a truck, and the USS Ponce was given permission to use its laser weapon system prototype as a defensive weapon. Likewise, it says the plan is for C-130 airplanes to use weapons as anti-ballistic missile defense that could be capable of offensive measures. He also acknowledged at some point, of course, you're going to have some kind of meeting and discussion to actually point out exactly where and how you can use a laser and where and how you shouldn't use a laser. But, you know, the White House is calling for an increase. Like I talked about, Donald Trump's increased the budget by $54 billion. And they said it's possible that this project could be able to be funded. So that's pretty crazy. You know, you've seen these videos for years. They've shown these lasers that, you know, like if there's an incoming ICBM missile and you could shoot a laser at it and just take it out. Of course, I've already thought of a way to stop that. Just make your lasers look like a mirror, and then when any laser shoots at it, it'll just deflect it off into space, right? Oh, no, I'm helping the Russians.
This wasn't called Project Crossbow, was it?
You know, it doesn't say what the project was called.
Was it designed by Chris Knight and Mitch Taylor?
No, I think Chris Knight is a musician from, like, Indiana.
Chris Knight is a genius there at Pacific Tech. It's kind of like Caltech, but it was called Pacific Tech. He was played by Val Kilmer in the movie Real Genius.
I don't know what.
Yeah,
I don't
the old idea. Comedy from the 80s. You've never seen that, where they have a laser shooting down from the spacecraft, and then it starts popping popcorn and tears up a guy's house and all this stuff.
No,
oh yeah,
no. I remember the laser in Spies Like Us. Remember they're at the drive-in movie theater and they activate that thing and it starts shooting out satellites and coming into kind
of. I think of the Real Genius because it is. It's like they're flying it around. They're bouncing it off stuff. This is ridiculous.
It's coming, man. It's actually surprising it's taken so long for lasers to get here.
I'm not laughing at the fact
that they've been around, but I mean, it's surprising that the military hasn't developed ones to shoot at each other yet.
I'm not laughing at the fact that this could be used for a weapon. I'm laughing at the fact that my companion over here has his emphasis on the word laser.
I'm thinking of Austin
Powers.
Yeah. With the sharks. Yeah, that's your favorite thing.
On the laser.
There's a redo. Like, you got to do tattoo. You finished your sleeve. You got that shark on your arm. I want you to go back in the studio and have them put a laser on its head. That would be even better.
Just a little laser with the beam coming out. I could do that. Yeah. I have a full great white shark underneath my arm, my whole forearm on the bottom side.
Oh, did we not talk about that on the show?
I don't. We may not have. But
I don't remember. We talk about so much.
Yeah. So that's the thing. Yeah. That's what he's talking about, folks. Wearing my fears. I've got you something here, Brud. As far as lasers, in Pennsylvania, there was a witness that reported unusual lights beaming to the ground.
See?
This comes from Open Minds. All right, our homie over there, Roger Marsh.
Yeah. Is this really an alien spacecraft with a laser, or is this, they're already testing this stuff on top secret aircraft?
You're right. Because you're going to love this. This is Cumberland County, Pennsylvania. It says, witnesses reported an unusual series of, and I quote, huge, bright, round lights beaming to the ground level near her property, and there was no sound that appeared, and it also got her dog's attention. Okay,
now it's probably swamp gas.
Yeah, it probably was exactly swamp gas.
Ball lightning. I'm claiming ball lightning
and swamp gas. That's what it was. Now, these are cases 82026 and 82029. Ooh. Now, where 27 and 28 went, who knows? Kaiser Soze cases, have no idea. But it says that 82026, that case, was reported on February 12th of 2017. And it occurred around 1:30 in the morning. And it says, this is when it was reported, February 12th. It occurred about November 15th of 2016. And this is what she says. It says, I sleep soundly. My dog started barking, which woke me up around 1:30 in the morning. I thought she had to use the bathroom, so I took her outside in the backyard. The backyard has an in-ground pool and a fence. Behind the backyard is a 12-acre common area, and at the end of this common area is a wooded section with a lot of trees. My dog ran to the left corner of the house facing the front yard and the street and was barking. She ran to the right corner of the house facing the front yard and the street, still barking. She repeated this 4 times until I finally stopped her and brought her back inside the house. And it says that the witness first considered conventional reasons what might be causing the dog to do this, right? She says that each time she was barking, she never did go to the bathroom. I thought, maybe she heard someone in the front of the house.
That's what those little dogs do, though. Yeah. They're constantly yapping.
Yeah, they're not saying what kind of dog, but that's what I'm assuming. It's a small dog,
right? I'm picturing a Shih Tzu.
Yeah. And they said that, you know, and the witness says that they have deer across through the area, in that area all the time. So, you know, maybe there's deer crossing that evening. Could have easily happened. Says this, though, but from inside the house, the witness looked out the front window and saw a huge, bright, round light. So it goes on to describe the light, saying the light was extremely bright, similar to an LED, but the light was yellow in nature. It had defined edges, no overspray of light. So it sounds like a spotlight, right? The witness says that I walked outside onto my front porch to see if I could get a better view. There were no sounds or noises. I walked back into the house and watched from the front window and saw another beam of light. So it's after a few seconds, a beam of light stretched from the round light to the road. This beam of light was the width of a car. It originated from the bright round light and then stretched to the road, and I could see the light on the road. The beam lasted a couple of seconds, and then it retracted back into the bright center, basically,
of
the
round. What color was this orb?
They're saying that the light was yellow.
Oh, that was okay, a yellowish according light. According to the, I'm here looking at the color of orbs guide, yellow means use caution.
Always, doesn't it? It always means use caution. Says the beam of light lasted a couple of seconds, and then it retracted back into the bright circle, and then they both disappeared immediately. Said the entire sighting lasted approximately 8 seconds. Said the witness first thought that maybe the lights originated from a plane. The witness states this, that there was no sound of motors or anything. I wiped it all out of my mind until I witnessed another light on January 7th of 2017, and now I'm convinced that something happened. And this is what they say, this is what the witness says this happens. That again, my dog awoke me in the middle of the night. She was whimpering. Now again, I thought she had to go to the bathroom, so I took her outside in the backyard. She ran around the pool 4 times without ever stopping to go to the bathroom, then stopped in the middle of the yard, this time facing the field behind the house, and the dog just stopped. Said at this point, a bright light appeared at the end of the field and consumed the dog and vaporized it. I'm kidding. I just threw that in there. Listen, it says this.
That'd have made a better story.
Right? That it was perfectly round, but this time it was about the size of the house itself. It was hovering slightly above the trees. I wish people could see my hands. And there was no origination or no point of origin that they could see from where this light was. Says either below, but they couldn't tell anything. But said the light tilted downward, and at that point, the light appeared then to be oval-shaped. The edges were of the light were defined, but there were no shadows extending like light out of it. So it's still, it's almost like it's controlling the light. Again, there's no noises.
Right.
And everything was still. Nothing. The witness goes on to say this. My dog, not only was I frozen and mesmerized by this light source, said the dog was also, and she didn't move. And this time it lasted about 7 seconds and then disappeared again. And as soon as the light disappeared, the dog ran to the front of the fence facing the front yard again, started growling. She growled 4 separate times and stopped. The witness says I immediately called for her. We went in the house. When I came inside, I checked the clock. It was 2:24 a.m. I looked out the front window to see if I could see anything or to justify why she was growling. I didn't see a thing and did not go outside and was extremely scared at that point. And they go on to say that she brought her dog downstairs and then she looked at her arm. Now get a load of this. She said her left forearm felt sore. So she said, when I brought my dog downstairs and looked at my left arm, it was bleeding, swollen, and red. The area was swollen to about the size of a golf ball. And within this swollen area were 4 bite marks. The 4 red bite marks were positioned to look like a smile. Above the smile was one additional bite mark, and that's what she's calling it, which is located in the center of the 4 marks. And it says the swelling is down, going down, but and the redness is gone. Said that there's still 1 bite mark. Said the spot still itches and is slightly raised, and it feels like there's something under this spot. And when I awoke from sleeping, I realized I had fallen into a deep sleep. And while it appeared as though I slept for a very short time, I felt as though I was completely rested. And it, one final thought was, it says this, that everything during this event occurred in fours, is what the witness is stating. So my question is this. Maybe nothing happened the first time, right? You just saw something. The second time, they come back, and that's when they come down there and they jack you. You come in the back, the dog's growling, and right. Whammo, they got you.
That's what it sounds like. I mean, it right? definitely sounds like they took her, yeah.
Yeah, and or whatever they did, but of course, if they did anything, but it, look, the pictures are there. If you go to openminds.tv, you can check it out. There's some pictures. It is odd, but it doesn't look like a bug sting. It doesn't. It almost looks, for lack of a better term, if you were to take like a the plug on the back of a microphone,
right?
The way it's got those little prongs on it.
Yeah.
If you were to jab that in your arm. Now, there's no, of course, ring on the outside, but it's almost set up like that, like a funky fork kind of thing that would stick in you, which would make you think if you were taking a sample for somebody or something, or maybe putting a little something something in somebody. Look, I'm grasping, but still, it is a little crazy.
That's more than crazy, it's creepy.
And what about the lights? No sound, no noise, where, and you, she couldn't tell where they were coming from. Said there was no point of origin anywhere. It's not like they, you know, it's not like they were emitting on the ground or being shown down. They couldn't tell, have no idea where they're coming from.
Well, speaking of scratches and tracking devices and stuff, it reminded me of this story I saw in the news. Check this out. It's about how evil spirits scratch and torment a woman and her young son. A young woman, a mother living in York, UK, says that her one-bedroom council flat is haunted by evil spirits that scratch her and torment her one-year-old son. Tracy Bruce, said the ghosts take on the forms of an animal, child, and sometimes a man. The hauntings are so bad that she has been forced to leave her home. She has witnessed her son's toy cars make noises on their own, while the toys are always switched off, and electrical plugs pull themselves out of wall sockets. She also claims to have been scratched by what felt like a claw. Now, she said, 4 days ago, when I got back to the flat and ended up being scratched, I know it sounds far-fetched, but I had my hair dryer plugged into the wall, and the plug came out of the socket all by itself. I then went downstairs with a pain on my back, and there was a big 5-centimeter-long scratch. It looked like a claw mark, and it disappeared the next day. Now, the article goes on to talk about how she has taken photos of the spirits to prove that they are real. And I've looked at some of these, and they do look kind of creepy, but I don't know if they're staged or not. She went on to say that, I'm sick of people telling me they are reflections or light or dust. I'm petrified to go back there with my son. I feel uncomfortable in there, and the atmosphere changes at night. My son would be screaming from morning to night. As soon as he came out of the house, he would be a completely different child. I felt like something is making me angry, and it changes how I think and feel. I've never believed in ghosts before, but I do now, and nobody can say to me that they don't exist. They talked about how Tracy is currently living with her parents in York City Council. As the York City Council, and they're refusing to allow her to move to a new place, as they said after reviewing the evidence of the case, that it doesn't meet the criteria to move a tenant to a new home. So what do you think? Do you think if someone has like a lease or something on an apartment or a home or whatever, and they're claiming they're being attacked by spirits and ghosts, do you think they should be able to break the lease and get out of it? Because I do.
Yeah, I firmly believe that. And the reason I believe that is because it is emotionally trying on that person. Whether or not it's really physically happening, you know what I mean? Like, whether you can prove it or not. And look, I guess it's just me being nice. But yeah, I would like to say, yeah, I would say they need to break it. I mean, look, find somebody else to lease it. Is it that hard?
I don't know.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I understand you wanting like some money. But if you're willing to tell me that big a story and it's really not happening and you're willing to go through all that just to break the lease, my hat's off to you. Break the lease. Cool. All right. We'll see you later. But if it's really happening and you don't do that for somebody and you let, you know, you force people to continue to go through it, how terrible is that?
Right.
I don't want to be part of it. I don't want to have that heaped on me. So I wouldn't do it to anybody else. I'd be like, look, yeah, something's up. I get you. Go ahead and get on out of here.
Yeah, I agree with you. Well, let's take a break, folks. And when we get back from the break, I'm going to be talking about a different type of serial killer, one that happened in Atlanta. Most people don't know about Atlanta's Jack the Ripper. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. On July 1st, 1911, a 20-year-old woman named Emma Lou Sharp sat in her house on Hanover Street in Atlanta and waited for her mother to come home. It was a Saturday evening, and Emma Lou was worried. Her mother had left an hour before to fetch some groceries and still had not returned. Usually, this wouldn't be a cause for concern, but these were unusual times. Just 2 weeks before, a neighbor of the Sharps named Addie Watts was hit on the head with a brick. Then, as the local papers described in a mysterious understatement, a coupling pin was brought into play. Watts' attacker then dragged her into a clump of bushes and slit her throat. Watts' murder had been just the latest in a string of attacks that left the local African-American population on edge. All the victims had been of black or mixed race. All had been young, all around 20 years old, and all had been women. Emma Lou Sharp fit that description almost exactly, but she was more concerned about her mother, whose name was Lena. Frantic with worry, Emma Lou set out in search of her mother. At the market, she learned that Lena had never showed up. Emma Lou started back for home. In the area that now separates Inman Park from Reynoldstown, She was approached by a stranger, who she described later, according to the Atlanta Constitution, as a tall, black, broad-shouldered, and wearing a broad-brimmed black hat. "How do you feel this evening?" the man asked Emma Lou. "I'm very well," she told the man, and began to walk past him, but he blocked her path. "Don't be afraid," he told Emma Lou. "I never hurt girls like you." Then he stabbed her in the back. Bleeding, she ran away, screaming for help. And Emma Lou's mother? She was already dead, her head almost severed from her neck. Atlanta's Jack the Ripper had struck again. Less than half a century after the Civil War, the Atlanta of 1911 prided itself as the gateway to the New South, with almost a dozen major railroads spoking out from the city. The business of Atlanta was business. Atlanta always ahead was the slogan the local ad men's club chose as the city's new motto. Inman Park and Peachtree Street were enclaves for the wealthy. For a select few of the city's African Americans, Atlanta was a model for racial tolerance. Black-owned businesses had sprung up on the streets, such as Auburn Avenue. Local colleges like Spelman, Atlanta Baptist College, now Morehouse, Morris Brown, and Atlanta University were considered the best black centers of learning in the entire nation. But for most of the city's African Americans, life was hardly perfect. Most worked small, menial jobs, installing sewers, perhaps, or cooking and cleaning in white households, then trudging home at night to dimly lit neighborhoods such as Reynoldstown in Pittsburgh. And while Abraham Lincoln had given black Americans the right to vote, Georgia in the early 20th century actively sought to disenfranchise black voters by such methods as the poll tax. Segregation, meanwhile, was not just the practice, it was the law. Blacks could not be buried in white cemeteries. They could not walk through white parks. They could not drink in white bars and could not cut a white woman's hair. In fact, a black baseball team wasn't allowed to play within two blocks of a white baseball team. These were all rules. These were all actual laws. And by 1911, the population of Atlanta had climbed to more than 150,000, and whites actively sought out to keep their neighborhoods free from black owners. That July, white citizens living on Ashby Street gathered at the Emmanuel Baptist Church for the purposes of suggesting methods of keeping Negroes out of the vicinity. Already, it seemed, four black families had moved into the neighborhood, and there were signs that more were on the way. The committee decided to visit property owners in the neighborhood who might reside elsewhere and ask them please not to sell any of their property lying in that section to black families. So, when young black and mixed-race women began showing up dead, it wasn't cause for much concern in the local papers, circulating largely among white readers and staffed exclusively by white reporters and editors. Papers such as the Atlanta Georgian, the Atlanta Constitution, and the Atlanta Journal were far more concerned about crimes among whites. Unfortunately, black-on-black crime merited little attention, as the Constitution showed May 29, 1911, when it buried a two-paragraph brief on page 7 under the headline, "Negro Woman Killed, No Clue to Slayer, was found with her throat cut near her home." The brief went on to say that a mutilated body of Belle Walker was found by her sister on Sunday morning after Walker failed to return home the night before from her job as a cook at a home on Cooper Street. But it wasn't until 2 weeks later, after Addie Watts was killed, that the newspapers began speculating that the murders of the black women were perhaps the work of a solitary killer. "Black Butcher at Work," asked the June 16th headline in the Journal. Although the story beneath it stretched to just four paragraphs, still, the final paragraph was perhaps the first in the local press that compared the Atlanta killings to the work of London's serial killer of the 1880s. On account of the number of recent murders of Negro women, policemen advanced the theory that Atlanta had an insane criminal, something on the order of the famed Jack the Ripper. 10 days later, The journal elevated Atlanta's Jack the Ripper to the front page. For the first time, the paper examined similarities among the crimes, noting that five Saturdays in a row saw the murder of a young black woman. But on the same day the journal was sounding an alarm about the possible serial killer, the Constitution covered the sixth dead black woman in much the same understated way as before, naming the deceased and concluding after just two paragraphs that mean whiskey and cocaine are probable causes. When Lena Sharp was found dead and her daughter stabbed, even the Constitution had to admit, in a headline, that the theory of Jack the Ripper is given further substance. The story underneath then recounted in detail how Emmalou Sharp came face to face with the man police believed was the Atlanta Ripper. On the next day, July 3rd, the journal made a page 9 mention that a local black undertaker, L.L. Lee, had offered a $25 reward for the capture of the killer. Meanwhile, papers throughout the country, intrigued by the prospect of another Jack the Ripper, began running wire stories with the Atlanta Dateline. Eighth victim of Jack the Ripper, screamed the Sandusky Star-Journal of Ohio. As another Saturday approached, the journal asked the question that was on everyone's minds. Will Jack the Ripper claim the eighth victim this Saturday? The story quoted an unnamed veteran cop saying, "It's coming," he said. "The Negro will kill a woman before midnight on Saturday." On Saturday night, July 8th, 22-year-old Mary Yadell left the home of W.M. Seltzer on 4th Street, where she worked as a cook. From down an alley, she heard a low whistle. She stopped, and coming towards her was a Negro man, tall, black, and well-built, and moving with cat-like tread. Yeldell ran, screaming, back to the Seltzer house. Seltzer met her at the door, then grabbed his revolver. He ran to the alley and found the man still standing there. But when Seltzer told him to raise his hands, the man darted back down the alley. Seltzer called the police, who arrived on motorcycles, but their search turned up nothing. Within days, black churches in Atlanta had fattened the reward for the killer, declaring in a resolution that the foul and unpunished murders have placed a reign of terror over the laboring class of women of our race. But the reward was useless. If it was true that the prowler who'd approached Yeldell was indeed the killer, his streak of Saturday night slayings had been broken. But he didn't waste any time, evidently. On Tuesday morning, July 11th, a group of men working on a sewer near the intersection of Atlanta Avenue and Martin Street, just west of Grant Park, came upon a large pool of blood in the road. They tracked the blood about 30 feet to a small gully, where they found the lifeless body of Sadie Holly, who worked at a local laundry. Her shoes were missing, and her throat had been cut so severely that she had almost been decapitated. Clues were scarce. Police found combs worn by the victim on both sides of Atlanta Avenue. They also found a 2-pound rock smeared with blood. Within 20 minutes of the discovery, more than 100 onlookers had gathered, and by 9 a.m., when Donahue, the coroner, arrived, the crowd had grown to 500 people. Because so many murders had occurred, and because even the police weren't sure which murders were the result of which killers, some papers called Holly's death the Ripper's seventh victim, while others called it his eighth, and another speculated that it was his ninth. In any case, the effect was the same: absolute hysteria. Police patrols were beefed up, but there seemed to be no pattern to where the killer was striking. Newspaper accounts described the deaths, especially since all the victims, with one exception, were hard workers and generally respected by both races alike. In addition, in an editorial, the Constitution chastised the police for not being able to find the killer. "What is the matter with the Atlanta police," they say. "Have not found the criminals themselves and locked them securely for further depredation? Is it indifference or incompetence? Is Atlanta in need of a police awakening or of a police shaking up?" By mid-July, Mayor Courtland Wynne began publicly leaning on the police chief and chairman of the police commission. "Why the police are unable to cope with the situation is more than I can understand," the mayor went on to say. No doubt the police's impotence was due, at least in part, to the fact that the Atlanta Police Department was all white. Within 24 hours of the discovery of Holly's body, police arrested a man named Henry Huff, who was a 27-year-old laborer. Huff had been seen with Holly the night she was killed, police said, and was arrested in bloody clothes with scratches on his arms. But Huff was only held on suspicion, and in the same Constitution story that described his arrest, the unnamed reporter seemed fed up. The police department has nothing to say in explanation of its inability thus far to cope with the situation, further than the simple declaration that it is doing its best. The story went on to say that the white community was aroused over the killings as well, killings that have served to intensify the servant problem. Faced with the police's impotence, leaders of Atlanta's black community called up authorities to hire black detectives. Leaders of black churches urged the city council and the governor to set a reward for the capture of the killer. Their petition was endorsed by many prominent white Atlantans, including Asa Candler, founder of Coca-Cola and a future mayor of Atlanta. Not long after Huff's arrest, police also picked up 35-year-old Todd Henderson at a saloon on Decatur Street. A man had seen Henderson with Holly the night she was killed in a drugstore not far from the murder scene. Emma Lou Sharp was brought to the station to identify Henderson. "How are you getting along?" Henderson said when he was brought before Emma Lou, who shrank back at the sound of his voice, the Constitution reported. But another paper, the Georgian, reported that her identification wasn't solid. "That's the man," she said initially. Then she qualified her statement, "If that's not the right man, I'm badly mistaken." The case against Henderson grew stronger when he told detectives that he hadn't owned a razor or pocket knife in a year. But police soon learned that on the morning after Holly was murdered, Henderson had dropped off a razor at a local barber shop to be sharpened. Although the case against both Henderson and Huff remained circumstantial, police decided to hand over both men to the prosecutor in hopes that a grand jury would sift through the evidence and decide which man to indict for the murder of Sadie Holly. Nevertheless, police themselves seemed doubtful that they had gotten the right man. On Thursday, 3 days after the Holly murder, 8 plainclothes patrolmen were assigned to night duty, and the police chief, Henry Jennings, explained the challenges his department faced in tracking down the killer. "The police department is handicapped, seriously so, by its small size, but even if we had more men, we could not stop the crime." The week ended with Governor Hoke Smith offering a $250 reward for the capture of the Ripper. Over the coming weeks, the murders stopped. But police, under intense political pressure, continued making arrests. In virtually each case, the accused was nabbed based on accounts of witnesses who had put them at the scene of the crime. On August 9th, the grand jury indicted 2 men, Henry Huff and a new suspect named John Daniel. Huff was indicted in the Holly murder, but the papers would give little information on Daniel, but said that his was a Jack the Ripper case. On August 31st, more than 6 weeks after the latest murder described as the Ripper crime, the Constitution reported that Mary Ann Duncan, a 20-year-old Negro woman, was found dead in an area called Blandtown, west of Atlanta, between a web of railroad tracks. Like Holly before her, Duncan was found with her shoes off and her throat cut from ear to ear. Despite the indictments of Huff and Daniel, both the media and the police were certain they hadn't arrested the true Ripper. That fall, the murders of young women resumed. The body of Minnie Wise was found in an alleyway on November 10th, her throat cut, her shoes removed, and the index finger on her right hand had been severed at the middle joint. By this time, newspapers nationwide were running stories about the Atlanta Ripper. Detectives from other cities offered their services, and Mayor Wynn was getting embarrassed. In a letter to at least one of those outside detective agencies, his office struck a defensive tone. It said, "Atlanta is known throughout the country as one of the most law-abiding cities of its size in the United States, and its police and detective departments are second to none. It is true that in some instances, Criminals escape arrest for a time, but even escapes of this kind occur in all cities. The letter went on to outline the strengths of the force, saying that 200 capable officers and 15 keen-witted and experienced detectives are on staff. But just a week after Wynn's office sent out the letter, Atlanta awoke to one of the grisliest murders yet. A woman with her head cut almost completely off, her heart cut out and lying by her side, her body disemboweled. Throughout the winter of 1912, more young women were found with their throats cut, but the pace never again reached the early summer of the year before. In March 1912, the Constitution reported that a grand jury had concluded that an Atlanta Jack the Ripper was a myth. Each murder was committed by a different man. In each case, it was the result of jealousy following immoral conduct. But the story, which ran just four paragraphs, didn't explain how the grand jury reached its conclusion. And a month later, the same paper ran a story headlined, Jack the Ripper Turns Up Again. In this case, the body of a 19-year-old girl was found in a clump of bushes at the end of Pryor Street. She'd been stabbed in the throat. By the spring of 1912, the daily papers were writing about the Ripper's 20th victim, a 15-year-old found floating in the Chattahoochee River, her throat cut, her body mutilated. Although the media wasn't convinced, police kept making arrests. In late April 1912, a man named Charlie Owens was sentenced to life in prison for one of the so-called Jack the Ripper murders committed in Atlanta during the past 18 months, the Constitution reported. The story didn't say for which murder he was convicted. However, and in a matter of weeks, the papers were attributing yet another murder to the Ripper. On August 10th, 1912, more than a year after the first Ripper murders had occurred, Henry Brown, also known as Lawton Brown, was arrested for the killing of Eva Florence, who had been murdered the previous November. Brown's wife told police that he had come home on successive Saturdays, the same Saturdays that many of the killings had taken place. Each time his clothes were bloody, and he would sit before the fire to dry them out. Under questioning, Brown revealed intimate details of other crimes. Detectives believed they'd finally found their man. But had they? That October, Brown went to trial in the Florence murder, but John Rutherford testified that police had put Brown through the third degree during questioning. Rutherford said the detectives chained Brown's arms to a chair and then struck him in the ears until he confessed. For his part, Brown said he often suffered hallucinations and would admit to almost anything under pressure. On October 18th, Brown was acquitted. Try as they might, Atlanta detectives could not convict anyone of the Ripper murders. Whether or not police ever nabbed the Ripper, if he even existed, the Atlanta papers did not forget about him and invoked his name several times in the coming years. In March 1913, the Constitution detailed the murder of Laura Smith, who was found with her throat cut. Like the other victims, Smith was young, of mixed race, and worked as a servant. Smith's murder was the third that year. Then in March 1914, 3 full years after the Ripper murders had begun, firefighters found notes pinned to fireboxes all around the city. The note's author promised to cut the throats of all Negro women who were found on the streets after a certain hour of the night. The newspaper attributed the notes to Jack the Ripper. In the coming years, in fact, when a black woman was found stabbed to death in Atlanta, the papers would automatically point to the Ripper. Oddly, one of the final mentions of the Ripper arose during the infamous case of Leo Frank, the Jewish businessman who had been charged in the death of 13-year-old Mary Fagan and who was ultimately lynched. Besides Frank, there was one other prime suspect, a black man named Jim Conley. In April 1914, an out-of-the-town detective named W.J. Burns said that Conley not only killed Fagan, but that he was responsible for the Ripper deaths. Nothing came of Burns' claims. Over time, as memories of the murders faded, most of Atlanta grew to forget the Ripper. Was he even real in the first place? Or were the murders nothing more than a bunch of copycat murders inspired by the stories of the Ripper printed in the local newspapers? No one seems to really know. What is for sure is that more than 20 women were killed in brutal fashion in and around the city of Atlanta over a 3 to 4 year period. And although more than 100 years ago, serial killers are still operating today. According to the FBI, there are between 25 and 50 active serial killers in America right now. While you're listening to this, perhaps even darker, they may be listening to this episode too. They may be listening to me right now, right at this very second. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. We're back with Expanded Perspectives. This was a case that I was unfamiliar with. I was totally unfamiliar with, probably because I don't live in Georgia. I have an uncle that lives in Atlanta. You know, who knew that there was a Jack the Ripper here in America? That's what they were calling him. They don't think it was the Jack the Ripper, so let's not get that confused. They were just calling it that because at that time, that was the most popular serial killer that people knew about. Yeah. So they were calling it, you know, Atlanta's own version. But they never really were able to determine if the killings were all done by the same person or if there was only a few killings done and the rest were copycat killers, people trying to, you know, for whatever reason, trying to get fame, and or they were all just eerily similar. And they're also not sure if they ever actually apprehended and caught the killer themselves. So he may have been free.
That makes me feel good.
It could be a woman, I guess, but let's be honest, most serial killers are men.
That makes me feel great. Yeah, we don't know if I got him or not. Maybe so. Maybe no. We're close. And then just leave it going. Is that what they just kind of like, eh?
Well, they didn't know. Yeah, so they don't know if they ever caught him, man. It's pretty scary.
It is. It's very scary. I can't imagine living with that. Well, like while it's going on. I mean, could you imagine having that kind of stress over your neighborhood and over your community?
No.
I can't even wrap my head around that. It just sounds awful.
But like I spoke about in the segment, I mean, it's scary that the FBI even claims today that there's probably 25 to 50 active serial killers right now.
Yeah.
That they could be listening to this episode.
No. Stop.
You don't know that.
Stop. Stop telling me these things, man. Just stop.
Oh, very crazy. But before we get out of here, let's talk about our sponsor, Gaia.com. I love Gaia.com. It's really cool. It's a video streaming service, much like Netflix or Hulu. They got over 7,000 videos over there, from documentaries to its own actual original programming. And some of those programs are pretty cool. And if you go to Gaia right now, you can watch a few of these for free, right, Cam? Yep,
you certainly can. Look, they just released where you can start seeing, I believe it's season 2 of Buzzsaw. It's hosted by Sean Stone. You'll like that. They do a little interview action going on there. Also, too, you can see season 1 of episode 5 they've released for free of Truth Hunter that we've been talking about with Linda Moulton Howe. Well, she's talking about the unheard truth behind Roswell's UFO. So if you want to see some stuff that, you know, that maybe Linda's found and kind of trying to expose some stuff, check that out. But one of my favorite things, and they actually have released this one, 7 seasons. This is the start of the 7th season of George Norrie's Beyond Belief. They've redone the set. They've redone everything on it. And the greatest thing is, he's hanging out with one of our buddies on this one, Kyle, Nick Pope.
Oh, that's
cool. Nick's going to be on it, yeah.
I saw Nick last April in Arkansas.
Cool. Yeah,
you know, when you're, like, you're talking about with the 7 seasons of Beyond Belief, check this out. Every episode is on there. You know how many episodes 7 seasons consists of? Ooh. 251 episodes.
That's worth the money right there. Just to sit down and just watch that show.
So you could be watching that for weeks, literally to catch up. And there's a lot of other great shows over there, like you were talking about, Truth Hunter, you know, some of the ancient origin stuff. I also liked Mirage Men, the documentary we talk about from time to time on this show.
It's still a great one to watch.
It's an excellent show.
Yes.
Because it lets you have a lot of insight in the fact that whether UFOs are real or if they're not, there still are people that are out there promoting disinformation. They're like, if you think that that top secret jet we're working on is a UFO, good. We're glad you think
that's
that.
That's what we want. Exactly.
Exactly right. So go over there to Gaia.com. That's G-A-I-A GaiaIA.com. They got a couple of different plans. They have a 3-month plan, they have a monthly plan, and they have an annual plan. Of course, the bigger the plan, the cheaper it gets. But if you join now, your first month is 99 cents. And after that, it'll be $9.95. And we're so glad that Gaia sponsors Expanded Perspectives because, unfortunately, it costs money to produce a podcast and they'd be willing to make a donation. They allow us to produce and make this show for you folks to listen to absolutely free to you. If you have any sightings or ideas or show notes or things you would like to share with us, you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show 817-945-3828. You can follow us on all forms of social media. You can harass Cam. You can give him tips on disc golf or whatever.
I'm going to need it. Go ahead. Send it this way. I need all the help I can get.
Go ahead and send it that way. Cam, what do you have planned for your week?
Man, if this weather holds out, I'm going to get a lot of stuff done, get a lot of stuff knocked out, and probably going to go play a little disc golf after work. Oh, and then I've been going to the gym a little bit, and I had to go up. Man, you know what? I'm just not a gym guy, but I got to be. I got to get healthier.
You don't have to do it in the gym. That's what I always talk about, is you need to exercise. It doesn't mean go to the gym. You have to find something else to do that is giving you exercise without you being in the gym.
Yeah, but I enjoy lifting the weights. It's almost like but I don't have the motivation to do it at home. So it's better if I go there so I can leave it there. I go there and then I'm done, so...
You play disc golf, but with like a discus, because those things are weighted. They're like 10 pounds. And then you walk around with a backpack full of weights, so you're lifting weights and playing disc golf.
A weight vest.
You'll become yoked if you can throw that thing.
And then wear those high-altitude training masks.
Oh, yeah, like the ones Boss Rutan sells?
Yeah. I'm going to do that. All right, yeah, we may try that. Yeah, I'm down.
Oh, man, did you see the results from the UFC? I'm so glad. Once I knew that the El Kikui fight was off, I did not even watch
it. Didn't watch it.
And I'm so glad I didn't. Did you see that?
Yeah, look, my hat's off to all the guys that fought. It ended exactly the way the last one ended. So I was like, man, I was really thinking it was going to be I thought one of the other would figure each other out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it didn't work out. So, you know, I didn't watch it, and I don't feel like I missed anything. You know, it's no knock against all the guys that fought. I just don't feel like I missed anything with that fight.
No. Well, I hope everybody has a good week. Stay safe out there. Be careful. And have a good one. For you elite members, we'll be talking to you again on Thursday. For everybody else, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Give somebody a big hug, folks. Peace.